Welcome to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete Sunshine 96.7 FM. Join us as we celebrate the sparks that ignite, the events that inspire, and the songwriters that create. With your host, Steve Robb.
So I actually do recall the time and the place when I was introduced to the music of John Pousset Dart. It was a summer of 1978 in a lakeside cottage, and a family friend's daughter named Lynn said, "I think you need to listen to this," because she knew I played guitar. And she put your record on the turntable, and out came the first notes of County Line, and everything just resonated with me, as did Amnesia and Fall on Me and Yecha and all these other gems. And it was just an eye-opening experience in a way, because I was listening to music that I really, 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 really connected with. So it's with great pleasure that I introduced John Pousset Dart. John, welcome to Song Creating.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
We are honored to have you. So we met about a month ago at a concert not far from here, not far from where I am. And I have to say, it was a great show. And I've seen you live probably half a dozen times over the years. And you have not lost, you haven't lost a note in your voice. And you've still got it. So you got any secrets to maintaining?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that I learned early on when we first started going out and touring heavily, because I was with Don Law, and he really stuck us out on the road. And we really did a lot of major touring from the beginning. And what I found was that when I was younger, I wasn't really singing correctly. And I created nodes in my voice from singing from up here. And from just kind of like reaching and putting stress in this point of your throat. And so I studied a little bit up there, and then I studied again in New York with a woman named Katie Agresta, who she taught me, you know, everybody from Phoebe Snow to Annie Lennox. I mean, you know, just a huge amounts of singers, and including opera singers. And what Katie taught me was that, you know, it all comes from your diaphragm, so that you're pushing from down and you're deep inside you rather than up here. And I learned finally, you know, the right way to sing. And I used to tape my lessons. I said, "Is it okay if I tape my lessons?" And so I would tape these times when I was with Katie. And to this day, every show I play, I go through that, you know, that rehearsal of learning this method of just, you know, opening yourself up. And everybody has a different method. Everybody who's studied, every teacher, voice teacher, has a different way of doing it. But basically, it's all coming down to connecting with what's down in your diaphragm, in your belly, and you push air up, and you're not deriving it from here. And when you reach for high notes, you're not looking up at the note, you're looking down at the note. So it creates an open space, and you plant yourself and you deliver from a deep place. And that's really where the opera singers come from, who have all this power, because they're incredibly well grounded, and they're pushing air from the proper space. And so once I learned that, you know, I was able to keep my voice, you know, in good shape. And so I've basically just maintained that, you know, when I don't do voice exercises every day, but when I'm going to do a date on the day that I'm going to work, I always do this workout before I sing, just because it allows you to find where your voice is. It just kind of, it's like discovering where your body is and where your voice is and where your air is. And once you have that, then you know how to approach what you're going to do. And without it, you're just kind of like, you know, sir, you're kind of looking around in your body for where it lives. And you want to kind of find that internally first.
But your voice still seems consistent to where it was back in the 70s. It's not like you've developed a new sound through all of this.
It's a little lower. It's a little lower. Like when I listen to the early records, you know, I sound very young to me. I listen to it and I sound like just like a kid. It sounds like I hear the higher you know, resonance in my voice. So, you know, I don't think my singing was as good back then. I think I've become a better singer from following, you know, and opening up more. I think I'm a better singer now than I was then. And I think that I've just been fortunate to be able to maintain my register is not that high. I mean, even though I'm a tenor, you know, there are guys who have deceptively high voices that you can't, like Michael McDonald has an unbelievably high voice, but it sounds like it's husky from the nature of his sound. But he's way up there. He's way up in the high register. And so everybody has a different characteristic. I actually like deeper voices, but I happen to have a tenor. My voice is just where it is.
Yeah. So is it safe to say that you got your start in Boston? Or were you started before then?
What it was back then is I was just starting out. It started from when I went out to this, you know, the whole background of what was going on affected it. You know, that was when the Vietnam War was going on. And I was drafted. I mean, I was number 57. I was called mm-hmm. to induction. And I'd written a paper in high school about the fact that I didn't believe in the war. But I was still called in 57. My number was called. You used to open up the newspaper and you're in the New York Times and you're on a list. You go, okay, here's your number. And at that time I went to college for a year in Stockton, California. And, I met John Troy, who became a member of the band, but I went to school for a year and I quit. And then I came back because I knew what I wanted to do. And I just started to, I picked up a guitar and I just started going around and playing hoots and going into the city and playing open mics. And I was going, and I went up to the Cape and I did that and played around the islands for a bit. And, I met when I was on Nantucket, I have family who've been out in Nantucket for generations. My uncles and grandparents. And, I was up there and I was, a friend of mine, John Hammond, was playing the Chicken Box, and a friend of mine got me up to play a couple of songs for him. And he kept me on to open the show for 3 nights at the Chicken Box. And that night, Don Law came. He was because he had worked with Don Law with John Hammond Sr. They were both talent scouts for CBS. And
Don just happened to be on Nantucket at the time you were opening it at the Chicken Box. Yeah,
and so Don said, you know, listen, what are you doing? Why don't you come to Boston and maybe we can work together? And I went to Boston, and in fact, I signed a management contract with him, and I started working. He just stuck me out. We did the college circuits, and then John Troy, who I'd been in school with, quit. We'd quit at the same time. He came out and started playing bass, and that was the formulation of the band. And that was the early 70s in Boston. And that was a decade, you know, that was, we toured our brains out for a decade. I mean, yeah. we were extremely heavily oriented road act. And so we did a lot of work at that period of time.
You're really abridging what I think is probably a much longer story, but you go from Stockton out to the Cape. So I think it was Stockton, California, but yeah. you obviously had some chops at that point. Don Law, you know, would not have plucked you out of obscurity if you hadn't already known what you were doing and were playing. Were you writing songs at this time too?
Yeah. When I was younger, when I was growing up I was born in New York City, but I grew up in Rockland County, north of the city in a town called Suffern. And when I was young, when I was about 10 years old, I knew I wanted to play guitar. I mean, I knew that's what I was going to do when I was very young. Because I came from a family of artists, and my father is a well-known painter, and my sister's a painter. My grandfather was a painter. My whole family were artists. And so, but I music was what spoke to me. It was like, I was really informed by my ear rather than visually. And so I would just take my sister's records and steal her records and then just play them and then just pick up a guitar and learn right off the records. And that's the way I started. And I knew when I was very young that I wanted to do that. And then when I was in junior high, I started a close friend of mine who lived right up the street from me was Jonathan Meredith, who we both grew up playing guitar, and his father was the actor Burgess Meredith, and my parents were close friends. And we joined the Sales Brothers, Soupy Sales, two sons, with a band called Tony and the Tigers. And we started playing when I was 13. I was playing, you know, with that band with Soupy, opening shows for Soupy Sales on Hullabaloo and all different things. And so I was writing and playing a lot when I was young. Back then, I started playing bass in the band because I needed a bass player. So, and then I went back, you know, but I had been playing guitar, and I started writing, you know, very early on. And I think I wrote Woman of My Dreams, which was on the first record, I think when I was 15 or 16. And then, I knew pretty much what I wanted to do. And I just pursued it. I just, you know, I knew it was a waste of time to be in college. And so I just went out and started playing. And if I hadn't quit school and done that, I probably wouldn't have had a career, because it was the timing that I think had a lot to do with it.
So what kept you out of the war?
Well, I was a conscientious objector.
And you had that paper to to prove it.
I got a CO status. My father was also a conscientious objector, so that was my history. And I was called, I did alternative service for a couple of months where I took kids from inner city kids from Philadelphia out to Pottstown, PA, kids who'd never seen farms and been out of the city. And I did that. And then finally, the war was winding down and then I just went off and started playing. And that was the end of that. And so, but that was kind of what was going on at that period of time.
Wow. There was a lot going on at that period of time.
There was a lot going on.
Yeah. It really was. Your music doesn't seem, let's see, you've got some political messaging in your songs. I think more, if I recall, that you had a current one or a recent one that seemed to be a little bit more socially aware, but it's not something that you're really put into a lot of your songs, if I recall from back.
At times I've expressed certain things. I mean, I was very involved in the anti-handgun legislation, and I wrote the song "Put Down Your Gun," and also I wrote "Words," which was pretty pointed about what I thought about the administration of Bush and all during that period of time. And the latest record, "Talk," and that I put out, which has two songs, "Talk" and "Can We Just Talk," is really about the really awful state that this country is in. That's been brought about by a few people I won't name, but it's been I can't stand the discord that goes on in the country and the fact that people can't even talk to each other anymore. It's just this turned into this kind of rancor and anger over the simplest things. People just can't even sit down and talk to each other about different points of view. And that's really, I find that ultimately hugely depressing that this country has, been divided into these wide gaps and that people adhere to this narrow, very narrow thinking about everything. So, yeah, I mean, I've been writing about that, and I think that's about as deep rooted as you can get.
I think you played that at the concert and that song. That, so the album Talk came out 7 years
2015,
ago?
2015.
Yeah. So that you wrote that song even before the current lack of decorum.
Well, it started, that whole thing started really when Reagan came in, and that's kind of when I started to see this whole division of, and the whole, people are like, there was a really kind of awful period of time where it was like, I'm going to make as much money as I can, and if I have more money than you, I'm it's all just became just greed oriented, the whole kind of culture, and I found it amazingly depressing. And so I did, write things about it then and after. But yeah, I was disturbed about it pretty early on because, I think that the really kind of the great thing about the era that we came up in is that there was, when the Republicans and Democrats could sit around and have discussions and have ideas and be able to respect each other's point of view and have an open view that someone else feels that you feel one way and this person feels different, but you find a way to work things out. It's just gone. It's just now we're in this time in this country where people are just, it's profoundly depressing, I think, especially for children, because it's like they go, why is this all there is? You're on one side or the other, and and if you don't, damn the other guy. And, it's a really, it's a sorry state of affairs.
Well, I think compromise.
I don't think it's going to go, and I don't see a lot of hope that it's going to,
Compromise does not get somebody reelected anymore. And that's really all they care about is getting reelected.
Yeah, and just this kind of, this level of, belittling people who you might disagree with this person, but you have to tear them down. It's like, and why? What's it's just depressing to listen. It makes you want to just turn the TV off and just, not listen.
Right, right. So most people know you from your first three or four albums. This was like mid 70s into the 80s. Kind of fell off the radio tracks and the Billboard charts, but you really kept going. And what did you do?
Well, there was a lot of things that happened. One of the things we went out, when we signed with Capitol, it was the era of when album radio was alive. And when you would sign with a label, we signed a 5-record deal. So it's basically, you're on board for 5 records. And that doesn't even exist anymore. It's like, you know, it's long gone. So there was a progression where, you know, the labels used to try and build acts, and, you know, you would work with radio and promotion and try and, you know, like stepping stones. You're touring and you're going with radio and you're doing radio in every town. You're building like something that's like going up blocks and stairs, and you build it. And we worked very, very hard at that. And then there was almost like a perfect storm of events that kind of happened that deep sixed a lot of the things. You know, one of the what I can remember is specific times when decisions were made that just weren't, that affected us hugely. One was when we got to the second album, Amnesia, and we had recorded the album, and we turned it in, and Capitol came back and said, well, we don't hear a single here. We need a single. So go back to Nashville. So I went back to Nashville. And I did Amnesia. I wrote Amnesia and came back, and we came back and delivered it. We said, here's the single. And it was obviously the single to everybody. You know, that would have been a national single if they'd chosen it. And then they said, well, we're not going to release that because we have another up-tempo song this quarter from some other artist, Richard Torrance, and we're going to go down-tempo with you. We're going to go Fall on Me. And it was the wrong call. It wasn't the time for that song was then. Mm-hmm. And so, it became a big hit on album radio, but it didn't hit the top 40 because they didn't spin it as a single. So that played into a developing situation where, okay, now we need another single. So, you know, the record labels are always looking for what's the single it's going to break. We need the single. So we did that, you know, worked towards that very hard. And then towards the end of the 80s, 70s, the whole musical scene was changing. It was a big swing with the disco was starting to come in. The tech stuff from England was starting to come in. We were in Capitol, and there was a band called The Knack that turned in My Sharona, mm-hmm. and they turned in the album for 10 grand, which was like nothing compared, because we were spending huge amounts of money in the 70s. The great thing about the 70s is we were able to be incredibly decadent and spend tons of money. Mm-hmm. And the chicken coop. It was just wild. It was like, you know, it was the Wild West back then. And it was really fun because it was just like that, because it was like, you know, there were no kind of, they hadn't discovered the boundaries yet of where things were. And so the Capitol just, all the labels just tightened the noose and went, okay, they're turning that for 10 grand. Okay, the whole roster's gone. We're going to just throw everybody out and we're starting over. And now here's what's going to be happening. That shift happened. Disco came in, tech came in, and I just started. And the label said, "We're done." They said, "We're finished. We're changing course."
Wow!
And so it became this era of, like, you know, trying to turn in records for nothing, and I grew just very disenchanted. And at the same time that happened, we went out on our last tour, and the record we just turned in. Stand By Me, and it went to the top, it hit like the top 40, and it just barely broke the top 40, went out, and so we were going on tour to support that record, and at the 2 days before we were going to leave, they said we're pulling the tour support. So we had to go out to the Bank of Boston and take a loan so we could pay for the bus to go across the country and back. We went out and did 60 nights in a row, came back, and didn't have a cent. We were totally broke, and the band just went, okay, that's it.
Wow.
You know, so it was a very, you know, it was, you know, we were putting in all the work, and, you know, it was very depressing to not have the return. So the band kind of disbanded. We did one more record, and then that period ended. And also at that point I left Dawn. I had a major divorce. So it was like a perfect storm of things that were just kind of coming, you know, the whole picture turned upside down. So at that time, I went back to New York, and I started. I still played with a couple of different bands with a bunch of New York players who were great, and I started. I met a guy named Tony Smythe, who was he owned a jingle house, and he knew music. And he said, "Why don't you come in and work with us?" And I started work for him, and I got involved with doing session work and singing on a lot of jingles through the early '80s, which is when there was a ton of money in that there was a lot of money in sessions doing that back then. And so I did that for a while, and I kept writing, but the climate of the music scene didn't feel very fortuitous to me. It didn't feel like it was song oriented. It felt like it was who had the biggest hair, and, you know, it was all very trend driven. And then at the end of the '80s, I used to work a lot with Bonnie Raitt early on. We did a lot of work, and Bonnie, even back then, Capitol wanted, was interested in Bonnie. They were asking me about Bonnie back then when she was on Warner's, and they signed her, and she turned in her first record for Capitol and had, you know, the Mike Reed hit, you know, which is a huge song. Oh. And it was,
You can't make you love me.
And all of a sudden it was like, you know, their female artists were starting to be embraced. And when I saw the female artists starting to be embraced by labels, I went, that's the, now we're back to songs, you know? And that's when I started to dig in again and started kind of, you know, really trying to, actively, engage. And I was approached by a label in Nashville, which was Asylum Nashville at that time. And, there was an A&R guy there who knew this stuff, and he said, what are you doing? He said, why don't you come down here? And he set me up with a whole list of co-writes with just all the people I, you know, were huge writers to me, and I'd never co-written before. So I just went down, and I had 2 weeks of co-writes, 10 days in a row. And so I just walked in, started co-writing point blank, and just put the fear of God in me. And so I went down, took a bunch of notes, and just walked in every day and wrote with different writers. And it opened up another path to a lot of deep friendships in Nashville. And so they didn't sign the record, but I wound up with all the songs. So I got a lot of good songs out of it. And then I'd use those for my own solo records. And that got me plugged back into Nashville because, you know, what most people don't know is that when we first started recording, even though we were from Boston, we were recording in Nashville the entire time. So the first thing the Capitol did when we signed was they sent us down to Nashville with Norbert Putnam. And he was a legendary, you know, they were part of Area Code 615. And they were like the last rhythm section that did Presley had before he died. So he was, you know, these guys were like deep, deep bench of players. And it was like the Memphis Muscle Shoals guys. And that's who we landed with first in Nashville. So it kind of pulled me back to that. And one of the things also then, when we first went down to record with Norbert, and it was early 70, you know, 74 maybe, we flew down there, walked in to his legendary room called Quadrophonic. And I walked in the studio, and they were just finishing up the mixes to Drift Away by Dobie Gray, and, you know, which was one of, I think, the greatest rock and roll singles ever made. I love that.
Sure.
That song. And Reggie Young was there. It was my hero. I mean, I just worship Reggie Young and Steve Gibson and like that whole section of guys. And I remember making a mental note when I was a kid. I was going, someday I would like to make a record with these guys, because they were like the hits, you know, there was the major deep, deep bench who were on many, many records I grew up with. So then in 2015, I was going to do a record, and I met a producer named Bill Vorndick, who was just amazing, amazing guy. He's done Alison Krauss, you know, you name it. He's got his discography. He just died. His discography is just out the window. And we decided to do a record. And when we were doing the pre-production, I said, I'd love to do this. And he pulled together Reggie Young and the Memphis and the Muscle Shoals guys. And so it was almost like paying homage to that first visit when I first arrived in Nashville. So it was almost like a perfect circle. And that was, so that was nice. So I have a lot of, you know, very deep, close relationships with writers and friends in Nashville still. And I have a place down there, which I've been renting out since the pandemic. But Nashville's been a very strong connection for me.
Yeah, great. Where do you live now?
I live up the Hudson in the Hudson Valley, up near Bear Mountain Bridge. There's a town called Cold Spring. I'm right there.
Okay.
And I have a studio here. And we still have a place in the city. My wife, we have an apartment in New York City, but I've kind of bailed on the city. I'm pretty much here. And I have a place in Nashville, which I've been renting out.
Yeah, great. So recording in Nashville back in the 70s, I just want to go back to that. This was before, I guess, Boston became Boston and a recording, because there was a lot of great studios that opened up in Boston, but that was probably late 70s or so, I think, when they...
Well, there was good studios in Boston. There was you know, Blue Jay, which is a good room we cut in. But back then... there wasn't the, you know, the amount, but there are definitely good rooms around. But Nashville is just an oasis of recording. I mean, it's just, I mean, probably Nashville is probably one of the best places in the world to record, simply because some of the best studios in the world are there. I mean, they're everywhere now, but Nashville just happens to have a huge amount, as well as a really incredibly deep bench of players. It's, you know, it's not just country. People think of Nashville as just country. It's not that way. There's just there's just monstrous players everywhere around town, and it's really easy to record there. So you can just, you know, you can just drive downtown and you can do a session. And it's nowhere near as difficult as, let's say, recording in New York and all and many other places. It's just so easy to work down there, and I think that's why it's always been attractive. And also, it's always been very attractive because it's a touring base. It's centered in the middle of the country, so you can tour out very easily from there. So it's a really kind of logical and good place to be. To be involved with all aspects of music.
And your sound seems to be more a Nashville sound. You've got the slide guitars, the dobros, the banjo picking that tends to permeate through your early music.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've always really loved country blues and folk. I mean, I love the roots of American music, and I don't think I'm a country. I'm definitely not a country artist, but I love. I really, really love the roots of American music, you know, from folk to country blues to jazz to, you know, all the things that were at the very root of the American, the roots of America, period. You know, America's just was steeped in a rich tradition of great music. And so I still love that stuff the most. That's what I still listen to the most.
Did you ever think about how would you categorize your music? I've thought about that, and contemporary folk. I don't know what
That's always been difficult. It's always been difficult for me to answer that because I draw from all styles. I mean, there's blues in there. There's country. There's rock. There's folk. You know, there's some pop. You know, I mean, it's like whatever you call these things. I mean, one of the things that was the most difficult thing about radio, even in the days of album radio, was the labels really needed to carve up things into categories in order to get radio play, and that you would get allocated to certain places, you know, and that shoot. And so we were kind of allocated, I guess, to the pop rock shoot. But the thing is, there was much more folk in my music than was ever recognized, and blues too. But, you know, and strangely enough, you know, the real, you know, tried and true folk people never accepted me because they looked at me as being too pop and rock for folk. So it was like there was all these divisions that were kind of stupid, you know, really, just because music doesn't need to be divided up that way. But the sales aspect of marketing, you know, always, you know, needed to kind of stick things in these, you know, get shelved in certain ways. So I, you know, today I'd say I'm probably, you know, a singer songwriter, you know, and I do all styles of music. I don't know what else to say. It has rock, it has folk, it has blues, it has country blues, it has, you know, there's all kind of different elements in it.
It does. It has a lot. And you listen to, you know, you've got these beautiful soft songs like Yecha and, then you've got this funk, you know, from like Amnesia, things, and on the same album, and you really can't. It's hard to categorize anything.
It
like
is.
That.
I mean, I think that I got that from just deciding to be. You know, one of the things that I learned early on from being in my family was that, you know, in our family, my father was a abstract expressionist. He's, you know, known worldwide. My sister and my family, we curate his work now. We have shows going on for his work all over. And, you know, he was someone who really believed vehemently in following your own path and not kind of trying to be adhere to anybody else's standards. You know, he was almost anti-academic, you know, like really being true to yourself. And one of the things I learned from him was kind of what I didn't want to be. You know, it was like almost identifying what I don't want to be by just maintaining my own, you know, my own voice. And I've tried to do that my entire career, is just be who I am as opposed to trying to be sound like something else. And that's I think that might be one reason why it bridges us, you know, it bridges through so many territories, because I've never tried to just be, you know, I want to try and write hit songs. You know, I find one of the worst things to think about when you're writing is just trying to think about writing a hit song. That's like almost the kiss of death to think that way. It just doesn't add up to anything.
You're listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete, Sunshine 96.7 FM. Welcome back to Song Creating. We're here with John Pousset Dart. So, John, let's talk about your writing style, because you've got some great bridges and really some where you take things out. I'm thinking like in What Can I Say, where all of a sudden it goes bump ba da ba ba da ba, and then you swing it back. So you've got, it's not just a melodic bridge. You really go a little further, and I noticed that with a number of your songs that it seems like you really think, how can I make this song even more intricate or entertaining in a way than the standard, you know, three verse, two chorus, and bridge.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it comes from just wanting to explore things that to my ear sound interesting. You know, one of the things that's affected that, like, for instance, that song is when I first started out playing, I was self-taught, and I didn't know, when I first picked up guitar, I didn't know the guitars were supposed to be in a particular tuning. So I would just make up tunings. I started experimenting with open tunings. And I was also left-handed. I didn't know, you know, you were supposed to play right-hand. Somebody said, oh, left-handed guitars are more expensive. So I switched when I was just a kid. And my guitar player, amazingly enough, Jim Chaplin, did the same thing. He switched from, we're both lefties and we play righty. So I'm a complete lefty, but I play guitar righty. But I started, you know, making up tunings. And so then I landed upon some tunings which really affected the songs and the structures. One of the first tunings I kind of landed on when I was younger was C tuning, which is a very modal tuning. It's just C, G, C, G, C, E. It's very all stacked fives. And it's very, like very modal, and it's very open and warm. And a lot of early songs I wrote in that were based around that, how that occurs on the guitar and with the fingerings and the voicings. So like Freezing Hot and Yecha and Smile on Me, and a lot of those early songs were all in open C. Hmm. Not too many people use C. Joni Mitchell uses it some. Tom Rush, I know, uses it, and Leo Kottke, but it's not like a bluesy tuning. It's more open. And then I was very blues influenced, and I listened to a lot of early blues, and I levitated towards open G. You know, open G, D, E, and are really good blues tunings, and so I started using G, open G a lot, and that affected the songs that I was writing, because I was using the structure, you know, using the characteristics of the guitar neck with those voicings. And so those songs, like What Can I Say, and, you know, quite a few, Amnesia, you know, many others were, There's Been a Mistake. A lot of things I've written lately are in G. And so, and then one of the things I had to think about is, when you're performing, the last thing you want to do is be tuning in front of a crowd. So I started to kind of consciously think about directing my energy towards open G and regular tuning, so I could get down to two guitars to switch between, to carry the body and the material that I was writing. So it would stay, because I remember reading about Joni Mitchell, where she said she had something like 16 different tunings. She said it was like completely schizophrenic trying to perform, because she could, all these things were written in different tunings. And ironically, a friend of mine, Ken Parker, was a great guitar maker, introduced her to the system where she could do multiple tunings on one guitar through the VGA system. So he was a great help to her, because before she was struggling with that.
But that's why she's been playing those Parker
Nightflies. Ken Parker developed that. The patent was stolen from him by Washburn, but he invented that, and he's a brilliant guitar. I mean, he's making guitars.
The sound of those are just incredible. But I didn't realize those guitars had different tunings, or you could adjust.
No. Well, what it is, the guitar triggers. It has a MIDI pickup on it, so that you can trigger what's called a VGA system, which you can use alternate tunings through a box on the floor, and you can switch between tunings on that. And so she utilized that for quite a bit, and it opened her up, her ability to, you know, get down to one guitar. But Ken was, his instruments, he makes a thing called the Ken Parker archtops, which are just mind boggling. Ken's a good friend. His stuff is out, just absolutely incredible. But anyway, so I wanted to get myself to a point where I could just, you know, have, between acoustic and electric, basically two guitars for each tuning. And so I narrowed down to utilizing G, which I still do a lot, open G and regular tuning. And so I try and stay within the parameters of that, because it's, I can go on stage and deliver the body material that I've written to an audience, and not be just, you know, tuning the thing on, you know, endlessly tuning on stage.
So you kind of had to relearn how to play some of these songs that you had written and played for years in C. You had to
The C tuning stuff is I just play, when I play C tuning stuff now, I just bring a third guitar for that. So it's okay. Like that guitar stays in C, another one stays in open G, another one's regular. So that's pretty much how it's allocated for me now, and whether it's electric or acoustic, depending. But so that's kind of what I have it down to now. So I can never get away with like bringing one guitar, because if I do, then I'm stuck with just kind of that body that's written for that tuning, unless I want to sit there and tune in front of the crowd, which I don't like to do, because it just kills time. It just wastes time. You want to just keep moving, you know?
You have a sign man who tells some good jokes, so you do have a little bit of time.
Jim Chapdelaine is like a brother to me. We've been playing now over 25 years, and he's an amazing guitar player.
He's great.
He plays with Big Al, you know, I don't know if you know Al Anderson from NRBQ, is one of the greatest guitar players on the planet, and one of my favorite guitar players and songwriters as well. He plays with Al as well. But Jim is a monstrous musician, and he also is an amazing engineer, producer, mastering engineer. I mean, he's got the whole kitchen sink at his disposal, because he's so talented. And so we've done a lot, both with writing, producing, engineering, you know, recording and playing live. So there's a large, he and I have a large body of stuff we do together. And now, more than ever, I've gone back to working with mostly duo, trio. The band was at TCAM, but I'm focusing now on duo with Jim and also trio with him and Steve Ruse on the stand-up bass. Mm-hmm. Because I'm really liking kind of the intimate close feel that just staying acoustic brings you. It brings the audience right into your, you know, perspective. And to me, that's always been the real barometer of what a successful song is. When you write a song and, you know, a guitar vocal, it has to live, you know, sitting down playing for someone right here immediately. And if it doesn't have a life there, then you don't have a good song, you know. That to me is the test if a song stands up and communicates when you're just sitting in a room with just a few people and they hear it. You know, it's not the production, it's the song. So that's what I'm pretty much always aiming for, is to have something that has the body and the emotion and the heart and soul of it are alive in the most primitive setting, you know. And that's if I don't have that, then I don't really continue with something. I throw it out and try and find something that does have that.
So when you're sitting down and in Nashville, I imagine when you did these co-writes, you had to sit down and force that song to come out, and it may have been work to it, but there are also times where you've got the song that just kind of writes itself. And I think we want to talk about that one. This is All Your Lonely Hours was one of those.
Yeah. So I think the thing that I like the most about in the early on the first record, there were a good body of songs that came from the very innocence of youth, when you're just kind of, you know, you're not thinking that much. You're just kind of, you're in this space where you're just open and you're just creating, and you're not thinking about anything. It's just like you're just trying to let things happen. And the best things for me, and you know, to this day, even the songs early, some of those songs from back then still have a real strength to me, because they're not like intellectualized or thought out. They're just almost, I put it to like, it's like you're receiving something. You're like an antenna, and you're just open enough that when you sense something coming, you have the sense to write it down and get it down immediately as it comes. And so you're almost like recording, you're almost like a vehicle for it as opposed to the writer of it. And it's just a matter of being open enough. And so your whole awareness is open enough to receive it. And it's almost like, you know, it almost comes straight out of dreams. You know, there was a time when I used to try and keep a tape recorder next to me to record dreams, because a lot of that was kind of what, because you just, your brain just comes up with these things. In a million years, you couldn't try and create. It just kind of does. And if you're open enough, you can kind of catch it. It's almost like let me get rid of this. If it's like when rain falling down, you know, you need something to drink and the rain's coming down, but you go, I don't have any water. Well, if you put a bucket out there and you catch it, then you have the sense to know you can catch some of that stuff while it's coming. And so it's kind of, you know, it's like being open enough to be able to just basically receive it and get it down and put it in some form that you can make work. And so some of those early songs came from, like Woman of My Dreams came from that. All Your Lonely Hours came from that. There's Been a Mistake came from that.
Now, Woman of My Dreams, you said you wrote that at about the age of 15.
16, 15, 16.
So, well, first off, I have to ask, was there a woman?
No, I wrote that after I heard the first Jimi Hendrix record, and I just went, and I just wrote the song.
Yeah. No one particular girl. Yeah.
It just kind of came. So that's the great thing. That's the great thing about songwriting, is because now, so there's that. And then, you know, when I started going back to Nashville, it's the complete opposite. It's like you're going in and, you know, Nashville is like the Tin Pan Alley. If like you get up at 9 a.m. and you sit down with somebody, you write, two verses, you know, from 9 to 10, and you go out for lunch and you come back and then you write a chorus and the third verse and you're done. So it's like, it's almost approached more like almost machinery. You know, I mean, there used to be back mm-hmm. then in the 80s, you know, you'd go, when I'd go write with people, there were like established writers who were different houses, publishing houses. And these guys would have like a chart on the wall and they go, well, you know, Martina McBride's cutting, Travis Tritt's cutting, these guys are cutting, they need a single. And so they'd go look, okay, well, I'm going to try and write this song. So it was like almost like a targeted, you know, trying to write a hit for this guy and hit, write a hit for, and you know, that didn't work for me. I mean, you know, I don't really want to try and write a hit song for someone else. I want to write a song that connects, you know, that I'm doing something that I have a connection with. So even when I was writing with other writers down there, I wasn't writing to write for, you know, someone or you know, or to get a hit. I was writing to try and write a good song, as good as, and I happened to be able to do it with, I did pretty well writing with a number of writers that I really connected with. And
now, what do you define as a good song?
A song that just pulls you in and has a life of its own. The, you know, the songs are like children. It's like you write some and they just disappear. Mm-hmm. You write others and they just stay and they don't go away.
It may not become a hit song though. So you're,
no, I don't think it has. I don't think it has anything to do with hit. I think hit is a, you know, I think hits is a,
what's the definition there? Maybe I'm not. I'm unsure. You know, it seems like how can these songwriters are trying to write a hit song for, you know, Martina McBride. Aren't they always trying to write a hit song? Isn't that the goal in every day that they go in?
I think in Nashville, largely that's true, that everybody is trying to write a hit song. And I was never, or that's not the way I think. So I was kind of at odds with that. But I did want to try and co-write with different people to write the songs that I wanted to write, you know, to basically have, you know, a number of different perspectives on how to turn out the thing that you want to make. And it didn't, in my case, it didn't really have much to do with trying to produce it for something that's out there. It came for producing something for me. I wanted to write for me, not for someone that I wanted to please my own heart, not somebody else's. So that's kind of where I've always been. And then maybe that's why I've never had a hit song, you know, number one hit song. Cause I don't, it's never been my, I just, you know, I just, I think that it's a deceptive thing, you know, to be aiming at, you know, writing hits, because it's just, you kind of something, you throw something away immediately once you just even start thinking about that. There's something you lose in trying to do that. And to this day, you know, when I hear some of the stuff on the radio now, some of these songs, my God, there was a song, I listened to songs. I think there was a song called, Stuck in the Middle or something, you know, the song about, you know, Something in the Middle that was out just recently. And there's
recently, okay.
Eight writers. And it's like, song, there's nothing to it, and it's a huge hit, and there's eight writers. It's like,
is this on the country stations?
Yeah, well, it is. It's just, you know, I just, sometimes you can't believe that, you know, I mean, it's not to say that there's a lot of good things going on, but most of the good things going on are not what you hear when you just turn on immediately the media. You've got to kind of go dig and find the things, you know, in the same way that, you know, an interesting thing is that up in the north here, there's so many things going on down south in Nashville and in Austin and Memphis and different places down throughout in Muscle Shoals. There's just this unbelievable, you know, level of talent and writers and players that people up in the north don't know anything about. It's like, they're not even on the radar screen up here because these guys are just, you know, and so you got to kind of go hunt and try and find these things. And that's why I like writing with some of the friends that I've connected with down there that I've maintained relationships with are just monstrous, you know, really hugely talented people that I love to work with. Fred Knobloch, amazing. Daryl Scott, amazing. You know, and I go back and still keep trying to write with those guys because we've done Costas, who I wrote the talk with on this last record. And so, you know, there's just, I think that, you know, a great song to me is just something that, you know, grabs you. It just, you know, it takes you in and it changes you. You feel something that just, it has an effect on you. That's the barometer of a successful song to me. You know, whether it's a hit or not is not what I think about.
Well, All Your Lonely Hours, I think probably if you listen to it, doesn't have the makings of a hit. It's not that kind of thing, but it is a, it's got a deep emotion to it. You have some songs that have a really good, I call it swampy feel to it. You know, this one has a little bit of that, but you've got some just incredible chords in this thing that, and I watched your video playing, I think, not too long ago in your studio playing it acoustic. Couldn't quite figure out. So I'm not sure what the alternate tuning might be, if there is one on there. It's a rich tune.
Well, so that song was, I wrote that song in G, and so it was on the record. I played it in G, but then in order to be able to play it,
you mean,
now,
I just want in G tuning. You mean
open,
right?
Open G tuning, and then recently G, I went back to try and reproduce it now, and it felt too high to me in G, and I went down to E, and I just put it on the regular tunings. I don't see how we brought you to this place. And I am all the souls that you tried so hard to erase. I see through illusions that don't ever show a face. And I have stolen countless moments while you took another taste. In all your lonely hours, you surrendered them to me. And all the lies you tried to hide,
what's
it? B. Smoke to the fine.
Oh,
goes to the fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just got a richness to that song.
Well, that's just, you know, and so that was written in G, and because it sounded high to me now when I go back and listen to the original version, it sounds just too, you know, it's a little too light for me. So I wanted to bring it down to a kind of a slightly darker place where I could. And also, one of the things that I think is characteristic of a lot of things I write is I try and voice lead. When I'm playing the guitar, I'm usually trying to voice lead with the, you know, keep the melody tied in with the guitar parts. Like that is basically, I'm playing the melody with the voice.
Right.
I don't do that in all songs, but I'm usually trying to keep the root of the bass in everything I'm playing, so that you're playing bass and rhythm at the same time. You're not just going. You're just going. So you're voice leading. So you're keeping something interesting going down the root against what you're singing. So you can carry the whole thing as one thing. You're almost like an internal one man band. So you're carrying enough melody in the guitar to make it interesting. So it's just not just like, you know, slapping along, you know, like you're doing something that's carrying it.
How did this song come to you?
I just kind of wanted to write a dark take on you know, the side of, you know, there's a side of humanity that's really dark and will do the worst things, and it's just kind of like, you know, trying to say, you know, when you go out and do that, and you go and you do this and you do that, don't think you're getting away with it. I'm watching you. You know, it's kind of like, it has that kind of, you know, it's like a third body up here is looking down, going,
yeah. But, you know, when you listen to this, so the part you played where you're singing along with the melody has kind of a nice kind of airy, uplifting feel to it. And then all of a sudden you start breaking that
bridge.
You're bringing down that bass line a little lower.
You surrendered them to me.
Yeah. You get all to those low, deep chords.
And it goes with what you're saying. All the lonely hours, you think you surrender them to me. Do you think I never see? You know, I mean, it's basically just like, you know, it's kind of like somebody looking down at you going, you know.
This is on your Amnesia album?
First
album. So you had a full band behind on this one.
Original band. And what we did is we cut those records with the original band, and then we'd have, you know, Kenny Butchie would come in, who's an amazing drummer. He played drums on some of them. And then David Briggs, who's just, you know, these guys are just monstrous players. They would come in and add parts. And so it was like having, you know, these just, you know, we had the original feel of the original band with all of these kind of really seasoned. Norbert was really great at bringing in all these kind of seasoned veterans to just kind of, you know, really cement it and as a really, you know, like, so it sounds like a record. So it sounds like a really, you know, and he knew how to record really well. So the recordings we made back then were really, really good recordings. He was one of the best studios. He was known for creating some of the best mastering rooms in Nashville.
Hmm. Wow. So some of the recording you're doing now, I was listening on, it sounds like you might be recording these in studio, putting them on YouTube, and it sounds, I wasn't quite sure. It sounded like it was your own harmonies. I thought I heard your voice.
Some of the things I'm doing now are because of obviously because of the pandemic and whatnot. I have been doing things here that are just more bare bones, simple. Some of the stuff is just me doing harmonies, yes, and playing some of the things, and I'll send tracks out sometimes for other people to play. I have one of the writers that I've worked with for years, an artist who's amazing, is Daryl Scott. He's someone you should really dig into. He's a close friend, and we've written a lot together. He also works work with Norbert early on, so we've known each other for a while. And I just wrote a song recently that was completely different than anything I've ever done, which I remember when Miles Davis, when In a Silent Way came out, that record was really opened my brain. That just hit me like a ton of bricks. And I wanted to write a song that was kind of in that feel, almost like an improvisation. So I put down a song that was basically an improv. And then I sent it to Daryl to put pedal steel on. And that's all there is. It's just guitar and steel. And that's coming out. We're doing a film on that. I'm doing a film on that right now. So that's the current thing. But yeah, but it's all been born out of here. Because I'm a proficient enough engineer that I can get down what I need. I don't like to mix or master my own things. I like to start the project and get it to where I want it. And then I like to get another set of ears on it, just because I think it's better to always, go.
Sure.
Get it to the best possible people, you can, as opposed to trying to do it all yourself.
You mentioned Miles Davis, and it makes me think, who's really inspired you?
The things that still move me are the things that I always did in the beginning, which is, one, I always loved country blues and blues. And so, all of the old, original, I was really, affected by slide guitar. So Muddy Waters, Elmore James, Robert Nighthawk, Mississippi Fred McDowell, that stuff just killed me. And that's why I levitated towards slide, because it was just, slide just spoke to me. And Ry Cooder has been an immense, I think Ry Cooder is just amazing, amazing musician and artist. He's had a big effect on me just because he's so freaking, he's such a phenomenal player. And I convinced Don to bring him to Boston because I was such a big fan of his. So stuff that's fairly roots oriented, the bands that really move me are kind of the bands that were always, for me, touring with Little Feet was a high point. I thought I thought they were one of the best bands in the country. NRBQ, when the original NRBQ was one of the best bands on the planet at that time. I mean, they were just not the one that's now, because the original members, Terry kind of has got another band that has nothing to do with the original band. But, Little Feet, Bonnie Raitt. I loved Bonnie. I had a chance to do a lot of work with her early on. I've always loved Bonnie's work. Ry Cooder, amazing. Los Lobos, amazing band, great band. And Derek Tedeschi Trucks, phenomenal band. I like stuff that's kind of very roots oriented, and it's stuff that's kind of steeped in tradition. It's not modern or, it stays kind of very true to roots. And so roots music has always been, the roots of American music is just the greatest thing on the planet, as far as I'm concerned. The thing that I love the most is that by just going back and digging, down into the well of American music, you can learn more things than you can possibly imagine, especially now, because, when I grew up, there was no videos, there was no YouTube, there was no nothing. You just had to teach yourself, and you were kind of in the dark. Now, you go on YouTube, and there's just amazing players who are just going, here, you want to learn this? It's just out there. Kids can just kind of draw on this amazing wealth of stuff that you never used to be able to have access to. So it's a pretty amazing time for information, as far as getting information, if you choose.
If you had a tool, how do you get past a block?
No, that's a very good question, because I feel like right now I've been in a block. Pandemic, has been a very, very tough time. And where the country is right now, since, I don't want to, I know a lot of people get, I don't say a lot of things politically, because when I do, it's like, if I go and make comments socially, you can't believe the explosion I get, blowback I get, just the amount of people who just say, shut up. Don't talk about politics. Just write your songs, you dummy. Don't say stuff. We don't want to hear what you think. I mean, it's just amazing how the way people are is just kind of off the scale. And so in light of that, I think that in the time we're in right now, you've really got to be able to take what's out there and flip it. You've got to be able to take a very dark situation, a very troubling situation, and be able to flip it and find some hope in there that can be found in that, and by just looking at it in a different way. And so I find myself trying very hard to do that and finding it challenging in the environment that we're in. And so I found it lately. I've been writing. I haven't been, some people go, oh, I've been writing a ton since the pandemic. No, I haven't been writing a ton since the pandemic. I've been like really I've been really, really troubled by the whole state we're in right now and where things are. And it's hard to just, you know, and you don't want to just sit down and go, oh, you know, rant about this or rant. No one wants to hear you rant about what you don't like. And it doesn't offer anything. So it's just the way that you try and find, you know, to try and just invert it and try and find something that you can make positive out of something that isn't necessarily that way. And I find myself, that's what I'm usually trying to do. And I find it hard to do in the current environment.
Yeah, it is hard to do.
You would think songwriting, you know, you've done it for someone, it gets easier and easier. No, it doesn't. I don't think it gets easier when you're trying to kind of get to something that has some meat to it, you know?
Yeah. But it is an aspiring goal for you to try to find something positive in all that's going on.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the job, you know, for me. I can't speak to what other people are looking for, you know. I mean, and there's a lot of bands that just go out there and rant and just, you know, and, you know, it was interesting, you know, to hear. I went to Woodstock, the original Woodstock, and you know it wasn't everything was cracked up to be, you know, that people talk about kind of very lovingly. It was just kind of a big mud fest. It was a big mess. I was there, and we left after about a day because it was just kind of, you know, it was just like literally just pouring rain and just impossible to be in for me. So, but it was great. But the energy was great, you know. And to I just watched that Woodstock '99, which they tried to redo. John Sherrod.
Oh my God! Yeah, I saw that too.
And it was just like a freaking nightmare, you know, and the bands were just inciting it. They were just going, you know, inviting these kids to just, you know, the negativity spewing from the bands and, you know, that kind of energy. It's like, do we need that? I mean, do you need that? Is that what you look for? You know, I mean, some people love that, you know. I get it. I get why kids love that, you know, or rebelling and whatnot, but man. That's like the polar opposite of what I feel like paying attention to or addressing. It's just not my it's not my calling.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it seems like you found your calling somehow.
I don't know. Like all I know is that after all these years, you know, the more you do this, the less you know. You know, it's like you think you get more educated as you go, and then you know you wind up as you go. You know, I know less now. I mean, that's what it feels like, because everything is just such a, you know, it's just it's such a mad world we're in that, it's hard to, you know, when you try and put it out and define what's going on right now. I mean, I think that's kind of the job, is to kind of try and, you know, take all these things and kind of like try and, you know, put it together in a way that kind of disassembles it, reassembles it in a way that's kind of, that somebody might want to hear as opposed to not hear.
You know?
Yeah. You know, so it can mean something, you know, in a way that you know, you intended to be.
Well, John Pusa-Dart, we've covered a lot of ground here today. That's a fact.
Also, just the other song that you didn't get to, Who I Am, was just to go back to another.
Well, let's touch on that. Yeah, absolutely.
Another kind of writing, which is that, and, you know, when I've been writing for years with a woman down there named Jamie Kyle. Is enormously, she's written tons of stuff for Heart and Faith Hill, and she's great, great, great girl, great writer. And I was scheduled to go down and write with her. And then we had been going out to see Dawn's mother, who had Alzheimer's out in Bethlehem. And she had Alzheimer's. And so there's a long story there that's more than we can go into right now. But when I went down to write with Jamie, her mother just passed from Alzheimer's. So that song came together. And it's been unbelievable, the response that's had all over the place. It's been festivals all over the world. And people have responded. That's just amazingly, because... And, you know, so many people have gone through it. So you could say in a certain way, that's a hit song, because it's not a hit, but it has impacted so many people who've had a shared experience. And I think that that's kind of the thing you're hoping to do, is to just kind of hit that place when somebody goes, oh, I know what that is, you know. And I think that's most of what you're trying to get to, is just, you know, when someone succeeds, you just go, somebody sitting there, they go, oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, that song really did hit with me too, because I am dealing with that right now with my mother, who is...
Yeah, it's just amazing.
It's tough. And she still knows who I am, but I think that slowly is going to be...
It's a brutal thing. It really is. It's a tough... I know so many people who've been living this. So, yeah.
Yeah. And the name of that song, just to make sure we've got that down, John, is
Who I Am. It's on the Anti-Gravity record. And so that's on that album. And there's a video that's on everywhere. It's on YouTube under, there's Who I Am. There's a lot of other people use that title, but if you look under my name, there's a video there that's very powerful. As I mentioned, you know, Dawn had that, my wife helped make that. She's a filmmaker, and that's been in festivals all over the world, and people have reacted to it.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I'm sure you got more songs in your future. That's a fact. I sure hope so.
I hope so too.
I hope you have more tours in your future too, because I'd love to see you come through here again.
Yeah, well, I'd like to get back. You know, it's quieter than you'd like. I'd like to get back out and be on the road more than I am, because it's just, it's, you know, the road is the real equalizer that we both love. Jim and I were just saying in the last show is that we just lived, you know, it's what makes you know, you know, it's a connection we both, you have in your DNA that you need to be going out and playing. So it's necessary.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we've covered, yeah, we've no, covered you, a lot you, of ground and yeah. I really appreciate the time you've taken and all the insights you've got. You've got many years of experience.
Well, you know, I'll put it this way. I don't know what else to do at this point.
All right, John. Well, thank you very much. We are going to listen to All Your Lonely Hours, and maybe we'll just get both versions on here, the original and the latest, and let people decide for themselves which one they gravitate to.
Great. Well, listen, I really appreciate you having me. And I, you know, thank you very much for taking the time to have me.
You are welcome. All right. Thanks, John.
Take care.
I am the dusty highway.
listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete. If you like what you hear, you can find Song Creating on your favorite podcast app or at songcreating.com. To check out my own music, go to steverobb.com. And until next time, keep a song in your head and music in your heart. Thanks for listening.